Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. 24 hours ago, I was in an Egyptian tomb. I didn't know any of you wonderful people. And here I am now, on the verge of a madcap Chicago weekend. My God, you must really love this picture.
Me?
You've been here all day, and I've seen you here twice before.
You mean me?
Yes, you. You. This is the fifth time you're seeing this. I gotta speak to you.
Oh my God!
And a week after stepping out of that movie screen, Josh was my new Film Spotting co-host.
You just look so sad and lonely out there in the theater.
Hey, you try being married to Danny Aiello. Woody Allen's Purple Rose of Cairo, just one example of magic realism in the movies, a subject we explore this week in the Film Spotting Top 5.
Plus a trip around the world in Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer. Our review and more.
He's fictional, but you can't have everything.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1.8 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 20% off only footage clips on new accounts, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM714.
You're listening to Film Spotting. If we build a top five magic realism moments in movies, will you come? With director Michel Gondry's latest Mood Indigo currently in theaters and available on demand, we decided to devote this week's top five to a subject that Gondry has exploited to great effect in his films, among them Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, The Science of Sleep, and Be Kind, Rewind. We're talking about those moments when a director allows the rules of nature to be unseated by the fantastic. That top five later in the show, along with Josh's take on Gondry's latest.
But first, Adam and I have our tickets to ride on Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer. Hope you don't mind, Adam, but your seat's in the back. Enjoy the protein blocks.
This chaos. 1,000 people in an iron box. 18 years I've hated a train. 18 years I've waited for this moment. This is your world. The train saved humanity.
The engine lasts forever.
The population must always be kept in balance.
I said sit down.
Passengers, eternal order flows from the sacred engine. We must occupy our preordained position. I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. No, don't. Keep your place.
Those bastards in the front think they own us.
We'll be different when we get there.
What you say?
We take the engine. And we control the world.
When is the time?
Soon.
Josh, earlier today we got a tweet from listener Craig Bickle. He's at CBickle on Twitter, if you're wondering, informing us that he, quote, watched Burton's Batman for first time in anticipation of your SC discussion. Total schlockfest. Hashtag IMHO, hashtag sorry. Craig there is blaspheming, I'm sorry, referencing our Sacred Cow review a few weeks back of Tim Burton's Batman in honor of its 25th anniversary. We were both far more kind to Mr. Burton. It seemed only fitting to read this tweet a few hours before settling in for tonight's discussion because I can imagine a fair number of viewers lobbing the schlockfest charge at Snowpiercer and its co-writer-director, Bong Joon-ho. Through five feature films, Snowpiercer is his first English-language production, Bong has proven himself to be a master at mixing genres. 2007's The Host combined domestic drama, comedy, political satire, sci-fi action thriller, and B-level horror. His previous film, 2009's Mother, was part social commentary, part murder mystery and crime procedural, marked with a dark but occasionally silly sense of humor. By the way, both The Host and Mother were reviewed on the show and are available in our archives. Apparently, I'm good for a new co-host every time Bong releases something new.
So that's the schedule.
Be wary.
I've been trying to figure it out.
Bong here has whipped together many of these same elements for Snowpiercer, which takes place 17 years into the future. Climate change has brought about a new ice age, and the world's only survivors live aboard a perpetually moving train powered by the Sacred Engine, designed by the train's creator and master, Wilford. Up front, the 1%ers indulge in luxury. In back, the 99%ers, led by Chris Evans' revolt-ready Curtis, struggle and squalor, subsisting on Soylent Green-esque protein bars. Though, spoiler alert, the bars are not people. They're definitely not people. So where does the schlock come in? Well, among other touches, there's a certain undeniable campiness to Tilda Swinton's cartoonish overseer with her goofy hair and glasses and big false buck teeth, reminding the unwashed masses to, quote, know your place, accept your place, be a shoe, which, to be fair, does actually make a lot of sense in the context. That same campiness applies to Alison Pill's performance as a school teacher who fervently espouses the gospel of Wilford, and arguably to some of the special effects as the snake-like train slithers along the tracks, traversing a treacherous, inhospitable landscape. But back to Batman. Josh, we spent 30 minutes talking about Burton's movie, and I'm not sure either of us managed to sum up the joy of it as effectively as our producer, Sam Van Halgren, did in one short paragraph on Letterboxd. Sam wrote, Burton's film belongs to the same celluloid world that seems to have inspired it. Classic and silent Hollywood. Dames in distress and dudes in dress-up facing off in a studio backlot. Caricatures with soul. Dumb jokes and sentimentality lying alongside tragedy. A lot of what Sam expresses there could apply to Snowpiercer, if it worked for you. Did it?
Yeah, it worked. And Schlockfest, that term didn't come to mind, though it is a wild melange of tones, for sure. Mm-hmm. So if you consider it to be, I guess, uneven, maybe, is the comparison to use the term Schlockfest. A Schlockfest might be uneven, not well-handled. It jumps from one, from comedy to horror and all this stuff. And Snowpiercer certainly does that, as the host did to a fair degree. And it completely worked for me. Maybe it's because I knew that might happen a little bit going in, mm-hmm. having seen some of Bong's earlier films. And so I was a bit prepared for that. And these movies, you know, I don't know where the line is for movies that are gonzo great. They're just too much creativity and craziness going on. And it works. It's great. Or they go off the rails, as this movie could have done easily. It's hard to put a definition on that, but you know it when you see it. You feel it when you're watching a movie. At least I do. That's getting Terry Gilliam is a good point for right. this, right? Because his whole career, he's been jumping back and forth across that line. And so I can see a film of his and be all on board, no matter how crazy it's getting, no matter how unexpected the humor is in a grim situation. And it'll just work for me. I'll see another film of his, and for whatever reason, it just took the wrong track and things are out of control. Right. And I would consider that then perhaps a schlockfest. Snowpiercer isn't that. For whatever reason, whatever trick Bong pulls to be able to juggle these things, he does it here, and probably never more so than in that melee at the center of the film, where the group of rebels led by Chris Evans come up against this, it's not really an army, the train doesn't allow for that much space, and that's part of the fun here, they're so cramped, but this gang of guards, heavily armed guards, and they just engage in this brutal, slow motion, graphic hackfest is what it becomes. Yet at the same time, there are some really funny moments that the picture pauses for, and we probably shouldn't give any of them away. Just hint that the entire group pauses to mark a holiday, right. shall we say, in yeah. the midst of the dismembering, and then it picks up again and continues. And it's just that the giddy, unexpected thrill of where things are going to go in any given scene kept me in thrall mm-hmm. Pretty much throughout. There may be some moments at the end we can get to
sure.
Where things maybe get a little bit schlockier.
Yeah, I'm in lockstep with you on Snowpiercer, and I don't think we're giving anything away, really. Maybe there is something else you're thinking of, but that bridge sequence, I think they call it the Yekaterina Bridge, and there is this moment in the middle of all that fracas, they just stop, and they do celebrate the new year. And it's such a great moment because it is that sort of absurdly comic, funny touch that you would expect from this movie. And at the same time, don't expect at all. It really does take you by surprise. But it also gives you really good information. It's a great bit of world building. It explains yes. how this train moves, the timing of how the train moves around the globe. So it serves multiple functions there, which I think speaks to a lot of what is really effective about this film overall. And I did keep waiting. I think you suggested this as well. I kept waiting, and pardon me here for this bad play on words, but for the train to go off the tracks, for something so wacky and ridiculous and insane to happen that it would just derail the whole movie. And not only did it never happen, Bong's imagination just manifests itself in more interesting and creative ways as these revolutionaries make their way to the front. Every seemingly throwaway moment or little bit of character insight or character building, it comes back into play at some point in the film. This is really tightly structured, actually. And I felt a little bit like I was playing Let's Make a Deal, only with nothing to lose. What's behind door number three? Well, it's this SWAT team there to quell the rebellion.
When they proceed from one car to the next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's behind door number five? This perfectly balanced, harmonious aquarium with sushi that's only served twice a year. Door number nine, it's a raging, out-of-control dance party. Every door introduced a logical next step up the societal spectrum that was somehow totally believable within this whacked out scenario, while also surprising me constantly with the details of the vision. And you're absolutely right, as I had a blast with this film. I had a blast with this film the same way I do with other Terry Gilliam movies. And it's not just that there are similarities here, but there's a direct nod, I think you have to say, in this movie.
One of the characters' names.
John Hurt character. He's kind of the old guard mentor to Chris Evans, the guy who's been through everything and is the wise man here. And his name is Gilliam. And there is definitely a sense watching this that your term is dead on. Gonzo great? Well, there's sometimes gonzo bad. You definitely get that with Gilliam. They can occasionally be indulgent and insane beyond the point of no return. But Gilliam at his best, he shows you the world in a way that is brutally truthful, and yet like something you've never seen it before. And I think Bong accomplishes the same thing here with Snowpiercer.
It's the absurdity of the truth,
mm-hmm.
I think, is what Gilliam's best films get at. I'm thinking of something like Brazil, probably, which is also very much a societal portrait, right? And so I think Bong is employing that sort of truthfulness here, that things have to get so crazy or so out of whack or so jarring for us to recognize what's maybe in the everyday,
mm-hmm.
in some instance. And so I think that's a strength of this film, too, is that there are obvious class allusions here. And I think the movie sets those up nicely, comically, touches on them lightly throughout so that things don't get too heavy. And Tilda Swinton is a great point, a great example for this, because I didn't find her campy at all. I usually consider camp bad when the filmmakers think they're doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a movie that's very self-aware.
Right. It's definitely intentional.
Yeah. If it wasn't aware of what it was trying to do, it would be a disaster.
Right.
This is such a delicate balancing act going on here. And Swinton is pitch perfect in it. You mentioned one line of hers. My favorite one that she has is when she just looks at them, the people in the last cars, and says, "You suffer from the misplaced optimism of the doomed."
Yeah.
And just offhanded way like that. And the sort of the sense of surety that she has as a member of this first class in the further cars ahead, and how that gets undermined. And it's a really conniving character, too. I mean, she's mm-hmm. very funny, but also increasingly scary as the plot goes on.
Happy Ekaterina Bridge, you filthy ingrates! You people, who were it not for the benevolent Wilfred, would have frozen solid 18 years ago today. You people, who have suckled the generous titty of Wilfred ever since, for food and shelter. And now, in front of our hallowed water supply section, no less, you repay his kindness with violent hooliganism, you scum.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from director Bong Joon-ho called Snowpiercer. And I want to go back to that bridge sequence just for a second, because I mentioned it's not only funny and it gives us some world building, but it also underlines, not in a blatant way, one of the other themes of the film, which is the sense that even in the midst of what's going on, they have to stop and recognize this ritual. You know, there's a certain sense of order mm-hmm. to what's going on. And as the film progresses, you certainly see that more and more. There's a sense that even with that going on, no matter how out of control things are, when you do hit what milestones you have, what signposts you have in your life, you have to recognize them. And it's just a really great, insightful touch there from Bong. I do want to go back to, you've already basically answered it, but one of my concerns, Josh, I had in terms of thinking how you'd react to this movie was, we're always talking about whether or not a movie's too heavy-handed or not. Mm-hmm. You often think a movie is. I think it's usually fine, depending on the film. And I was curious if you'd be turned off a little bit by the potential heavy-handedness of this movie, because it's a clear allegory and commentary on religion, on climate change, on social inequality. The whole movie is about class warfare. I was a little worried you might find that more stultifying than stimulating.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a danger. But again, it handles most of that so lightly. Even the fact that it was global warming and humanity's attempt to counteract that kicked off this freeze, that's handled comically really in the opening titles.
Right.
And so it doesn't really push that too far. I will say, though, however, the problematic finale, and not disastrous, but just maybe why I didn't go out of the theater on the same high I was enjoying earlier in the mm-hmm. film. One thing is that it's very talky, and we do get to meet this Wilford. We maybe shouldn't spoil who plays Wilford, but that ends up being a very long scene of dialogue between Wilford and the Chris Evans character, which is interesting what they're talking about. It's very much about the class structure and why yeah. things have been set up this way mm-hmm. and that there are specific reasons for it. And one thing that's good about it is there are times when you're like, okay, I can see that. Yeah, maybe it should be set up this way.
Right.
So it's not that it's a terrible scene, but it does speak to what you're asking about. In other portions of the film, these things are just kind of tossed up in the air and part of the general commotion, and everything calms down for this dialogue scene that's at odds. Now, I think Bong is aware of this, because going on at the same time are at least two other, if I'm remembering correctly, and I've seen this a few weeks ago now, at least two other high-stakes action elements going on to the sequence. So I think we're cutting among at least three elements now over the course of maybe 15 minutes, mm-hmm. the final 15 minutes of the film. And for me, this is where the balls juggling in the air start to get dropped here and there.
Yeah, we agree on a lot of what you just said. For me, the ending, though, what doesn't bother me is that it's too talky, really, because I thought what they were saying was interesting, even if it is a bit on the nose. And the fact is, the whole movie has been building up to this point. We want to meet Wilford, and we're going to want to hear what he has to say. And of course, our main character, Chris Evans' character, wants to hear what he has to say as well. So that was fine with me. But you're right in terms of the way the action is blocked and the way everything is covered. There are at first just two things sort of going on, and then it tries to focus on this conversation, but then another action element gets brought in. And there is a sense of the space being a little bit too chaotic, which is in contrast to what makes this film so interesting to watch, is Bong's overall sense of control with the space as you traverse through this train. The way he visualizes these cars and the people confined in them, it's so well done that the chaos to the end does end up being a little bit of a disappointment, even as I sort of respect the ambition of it.
Yeah, and there are elements that carry you through as well. The performance of the actor who plays Wilford, I think, lives up to that Wizard of Oz expectation.
Yeah, and we won't spoil it, but based on cinema history, let's just say, it's perfect.
Yeah, it is perfect.
It had to be, almost.
It does work wonderfully. And there are other actors in that finale that carry you through, too. Two of the performances that I liked quite a bit are from performers who were in The Host mm-hmm. with Bong. And that's Song Kang-ho. He plays this sort of blasé engineer who the last car rebels wake up to help them through these doors. And
yeah.
he kind of doesn't. You get the sense that at first he's not really even interested in this mission.
Right, which is a nice bit of misdirection on that character.
It is misdirection, yeah. and it's also very funny. And he brings along with him his daughter, who's played by Ko Ah Sung. And they had the same relationship in The
right,
Host.
In The Host.
So they work well together. And another element of comic relief, you also have bit parts here. Octavia Spencer, I think, is great as one of the rebels. Jamie Bell, mm-hmm. who is increasingly interesting, I think, as an actor. Pretty disturbing starring part in Nymphomaniac with Lars von Trier doing something here, but also pretty compelling. And John Hurt, as you mentioned, is great. So having these people in the mix helps when the chaos starts getting out of hand. I was still latched onto them individually.
What about Chris Evans, the star?
Well,
he's potentially a little bit bland. I think they could say that about him in a lot of his parts, but I think you're actually the same earnestness that makes Captain America works here in this totally insane movie. He does keep it grounded for the most part. And I think there's enough doubt and enough darkness behind those puppy dog eyes that keeps him from just being a boring Boy Scout. I like Chris Evans on screen. For whatever reason, I've always liked him. Even in really bad movies like The Fantastic Four, he's charismatic and fun to watch.
I left him off my list for a reason.
Yeah, I was wondering.
it doesn't throw the scene off, but I think a different actor in that role might have elevated this movie for me. You're right about the charisma. I liked him in Fantastic Four too, and he's perfect in Captain America because he is sort of bland. He's charismatic and bland, if that makes any sense.
Right.
He's charismatic in a completely non-threatening way.
Yeah, but there has to be some kind of inner longing.
Yeah, I don't think
I think it's there. It's there in Captain America, or else at least the Winter Soldier wouldn't be interesting
right,
at all.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why is he so good in that part, but it's a longing for goodness, okay? I guess what Captain America has is this nostalgia for the way things used to be. So it's a vision for a good past that he wants to get back to, and I think Evans can tap into this. He has a speech here that really a lot of the movie hinges on that speaks only of real darkness. I mean, this is a case where we find out it's one of those moments in a Bong movie where you realize maybe I shouldn't have been laughing before, even though that's what he wanted you to do.
Yeah.
He kind of makes you catch your breath. And I don't know that Evans sells the darkness of that speech.
I thought he sold the darkness by actually underplaying it. I think it could have been a much more melodramatic moment than it comes off as, and I think it's effective the way it is. And back to the question about the social commentary, the political allegory there, I'm with you as well that I was never really turned off by it. I think that it's probably because it's not so much about the commentary. I think you suggested this as well. I don't think it's really trying to make any grand statements so much as say something truthful about the collective human experience. And I think overall it does. It says something about this desire, this need for order. And A.O. Scott, in his review, he loved the movie, and he said something intriguing about the fact that Bong Joon-ho just seems fascinated by, more than anything, the way this all works. And I think that's dead on. That's what I was saying in terms of understanding the space and the way he shoots the space and the dynamics between the characters and the different cars. That, more than anything, is maybe what he's really into. And I think that is what makes this world ultimately believable and compelling, even as nutty as the whole thing is.
Let me ask you, because you referenced it earlier, about the special effects. And if there's anything that struck me, schlocky is too strong of a word, but the world building was left out of the exterior special effects scenes. And for me, they weren't what I envisioned, for one thing, for a movie that's trying to convince us that the world had frozen over.
Yeah.
They're not terrible by any means, but they're not maybe what we're used to getting in a big blockbuster.
There's a sense that they're fake.
And I forget where it was. It might have been Letterboxd or Twitter somewhere. Someone had kind of pushed back on me for criticizing that and saying, well, that's part of the point too, is that, you know, it's part of just the comical silliness of it. And I don't know if I buy that, because you also mentioned how well staged and framed and set design, production design, the interior of the train is. I mean, that's intricate and fascinating detail being done there. And the exteriors and of the train moving just weren't up to that level. It did take me out of the picture a little bit.
See, it didn't me, though I'd like to come up with a better explanation why than just saying it matches the overall tone of the film. That said, I think it does match the overall silliness and sort of absurdity of it. And so it never really bothered me. It seemed of a piece with the movie overall. And I could even look back on something. I don't think we talked about the effects at all in our discussion of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes last week, but they're phenomenal, right? As they were in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the sense that somehow you believe in every one of these moments that these apes are riding horses and carrying guns and doing all these things and hunting or whatever. But it's the hunting sequence, not with the apes so much, but there's a scene early in the film. I'm not spoiling anything here.
Be careful.
When I say they're hunting deer, and everything about that sequence other than the apes was clearly fake to me. I had that same sense watching it that I felt watching the train here. And yet, because I so bought into the world overall, and I felt like the other effects, obviously, throughout Dawn of the Planet of the Apes were up to par, that it just didn't stick out as anything that bothered me, and it didn't bother me here either.
Yeah, I think it is a matter of buy-in. I mean, if you're all in on a film, then something like slightly subpar effects aren't going to throw you off.
Snowpiercer is out now in limited release. It is also available via cable on demand, and I believe you can rent it digitally via iTunes as well. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Before we get to our top five lists of magic realism moments, Adam and I will deliver a little bit of audio magical realism with Massacre Theater next, although I don't think there's enough magic in the world to turn the two of us into real actors. Stay with us. There's a fire going.
Folks, quick reminder that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. And maybe your next creative project, Josh, has to do with trains. That'd be a good idea, because if you went to Shutterstock and you needed some footage, guess how many results come up for trains tying in with Snowpiercer?
25,348.
Man, you're just like Karnak over there.
Close.
Amazing.
Close?
Pretty close. 353, actually, on trains. Type in magical. 22,762 results. If you type in realism, only 221.
Who needs realism?
Real life, way more depressing, unfortunately. But trains or magic, or maybe you're making a movie about magic trains, you are in business. You don't even have to shoot anything. Because whether it's for your website, ad, or multimedia presentation, or whatever short film you might be making, you can choose from over 1.8 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD and now 4K. Shutterstock adds over 20,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you find something new. And they've got sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. And the pricing is flexible. You can get them in video packs or individual clips.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM714, and new accounts will receive 20% off only footage clips. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off only footage clips on new accounts, use offer code FILM714. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I'm sorry, Chip. I bought a brand new suit. I bought new shiny red boots. I got my new headshots done. I even prepared a monologue from Bring It On.
Well, then do it.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. No, sorry. You're going to have to actually watch 2005's Be Cool yourself to see Dwayne The Rock Johnson's Bring It On monologue. It's probably the only thing that makes that movie worth watching, unfortunately. That was The Rock with John Travolta in Be Cool, the little scene, even less loved sequel to the classic Get Shorty. But Be Cool does, Josh, have a special place in our hearts here on Film Spotting, because as some listeners who go way, way back with us know, it was the first film ever reviewed here on the show, which wasn't even called Film Spotting then. It was called Cinecast.
Strikes me as an odd choice.
It was just...
Can you go back in time and remember?
Yeah,
that
I can, because I can tell you that it was March 2005, and Sam and I were debating when we should start. And at the end of March, or maybe it was even a month later, I can't remember the exact timing now, Star Wars was coming out.
Right.
The Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
And we thought, should we just hold off for a few months or whatever until we have something big to talk about? And finally, it was probably Sam and his wisdom just said, you know what, let's just start. What are we going to wait for?
Warm up and be cool.
And he was dead on. I'm glad he was as smart as he was and as he continues to be, because it turns out that gave us a head start on podcasting. Hadn't even launched yet in iTunes until the end of June 2005.
There
so
you go.
I'm glad we started in March when we did, helped us build an audience early on. And here we are 9 years, some months, and a couple co-hosts later. We are ready to celebrate our 500th episode Saturday night, July 26th at Chicago's amazing Music Box Theater. We do have our top five for that live show finally locked up.
Finally, that's just like well ahead of time for us.
It's true.
I mean, this is
it wasn't
two
the night
weeks
before.
Almost to prepare.
Yeah. Me, Josh, and some guests, Michael Phillips, Dana Stevens from Slate, we're going to share our top five films from the film spotting era. So 2005 to 2014, the five best films. I am dreading starting on this list.
See, I was really excited about it, but in my head, I was doing a top 10.
Yeah.
Now I realize I got to pare that down to five.
Only five.
Brutal.
It's ridiculous because I've seen some lists already starting, and our wonderful film spotting advisory board on our forum has started. And I've seen at least 25 titles I want to put in my top five.
Yeah.
So a lot of cheats are coming.
I know my number one, though. That's the only easy part of this so far.
Yeah, it's Pain and Gain. Followed
don't
by
spoil.
Cedar Rapids.
Don't spoil it. Cedar
now,
Rapids might squeak on there.
I'm
you never
sure
know.
It will. You'll notice, I'm sure many close listeners notice, that I mentioned Michael Phillips. I mentioned Dana Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
Great guests in their own right.
Yep.
No mention of Rian Johnson, the director of Looper and Brick and the upcoming Star Wars Episode 8.
But we can kind of still mention him.
But we can still mention him because here's the bad news. As we feared, Rian Johnson's duties as the writer and director of Star Wars Episode 8 has him a little bit preoccupied. He's not going to be able to make it to Chicago.
He's locked down at Lucasfilm.
For the show. He is. But he so wants to be part of the show that we are going to have a nice long 20 to 30 minute Skype with Rian Johnson on the big screen there at the Music Box. It'll be almost like he's right there in the room with us.
It'll be fantastic. I mean, we'll get to ask him what we want. He'll get to join in on, hopefully he'll be able to share his top five films.
We are going to ask him.
Is that the plan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give him a little heads up on that too.
We will. We won't make him do it on the spot. We have some other guests who are submitting video submissions that
nice.
We're going to play with their number one film of the film spotting era. So it's going to be a good time if we can actually get focused and prepare for the show. We've got a week off here to get ready.
And people should come with their top five of that era as well, right?
I'm glad you said that, Josh, because we are hoping to have an opportunity to get a little bit of audience feedback. And really, that's your assignment. You do have some homework. You have to come with at least your number one. You may get called on to stand up and regale the room with your wonderful explanation,
you
insightful,
be,
eloquent explanation for why it's the best.
You may be asked your number one at the door and not allowed in if you don't have the right answer.
I like that. I like that. So again, that's Film Spotting number 500 on July 26th. Everything you need to know about getting tickets to the show can be found at filmspotting.net. Over at filmspotting.net as well, we have two wonderful poll death matches going on. We pitted Richard Linklater versus Steven Soderbergh. Both started their careers at the end of the 80s, similar in a lot of ways. You can only pick one. The other director's filmographies are wiped out. You heard us debating that last week on the show. And
have you changed your vote since then?
No. Soderbergh's still getting my vote.
Have you officially voted yet?
I have voted.
Okay.
I have gone to filmspotting.net and voted.
Just to counter you and
I've also
render
voted.
Our discussion irrelevant.
There you go. In the other death match, our upcoming, we don't have a date yet, but at some point we're going to do a Sacred Cow discussion when there's some week where nothing compelling is opening. And we're going to talk about our favorite films of the year 1992. That's the next year up in our year-by-year countdown. And we're going to pick one of the classic, venerated films from that year to discuss as our next Sacred Cow. It's Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs or Unforgiven from Clint Eastwood. And like all good death matches, this one for 2 weeks now has been back and forth about 50-50.
Where are we at right now, do you know?
We're at 50-50.
Exactly 50-50.
Pretty much.
Well,
I mean,
so
a few votes.
Have
it's like
to get on there and vote.
50.03 to 49.97. It's that tight.
And there's no tinkering going on.
No, there's no tinkering.
Okay, good.
There's no tinkering. So your vote may very well matter. Please do go to filmspotting.net and participate in those polls. And I guess maybe just because Soderbergh needs some help here. Maybe this is a little bit unfair. I'm stacking the deck. But really, Josh, the answer is we only got one voicemail on the subject, and it's a really good one. Let's hear from Ben Flanagan, longtime listener in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He's got some thoughts on who should win the director death match.
Hey, Josh and Adam. This is Ben Flanagan from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Just taking a look at your latest director death match poll. And while it's still early, I've got to say the results are a little troubling. Actually, very troubling. And look, I love Richard Linklater. He's an incredible filmmaker who hasn't made one bad movie. I mean, Dazed and Confused and the Before trilogy, they're incredible feats in filmmaking, but Steven Soderbergh is a machine. I don't think prolific is even a fair word to use to describe the guy. He is not human. I mean, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Out of Sight, The Limey, Traffic, Ocean's Trilogy, Che, Girlfriend Experience, The Informant, Contagion, Haywire. I mean, it's a mauling, folks. Throw in the towel. It's over. Thanks, guys. Roll Tide.
Well, we'll see if Ben's eloquence there has any effect, Josh, because it is a mauling at the moment. It's Linklater all the way.
So the only voicemail we got was one in favor of Soderbergh. Your vote. Really?
Yes. Really?
No tinkering going on there.
No
either.
Tinkering
okay.
going on there either. I can prove it to
I'm
you,
suspicious.
Josh.
I'm suspicious. You can tell.
Yeah, you have no faith in me whatsoever. Final note here. I've been promoting it for the past few weeks, and I really do hope some of our listeners throughout Illinois will come down and participate. I'm going to be making an appearance at Illinois Shakespeare down in Bloomington Normal. It's where Illinois State University is on July 27th, the day after our live show. There's a 1:30 matinee production of Much Ado About Nothing. And I'm going to participate along with the artistic director of Illinois Shakespeare, my former college roommate, Kevin Rich. We're going to do a talk back after that 1:30 matinee where we're going to discuss the production and talk about the movie versions of Much Ado and just talk about sort of updating Shakespeare and modern versions of Shakespeare. The info for tickets about that is also available at filmspotting.net, and you get 10% off if you use the code FILM on Ticketmaster. So I encourage you to go to filmspotting.net and click on that link. If you're going to be anywhere in the area, it's a really good show. And Josh, it was actually my first time ever seeing the play, Much Ado About Nothing, performed. My wife and I just went down. No, I'd never seen it. We went down just this past Friday night to Illinois Shakespeare. Beautiful outdoor venue for the evening productions. And 430 seats, and they do it, as Kevin discussed here on the show a month or so ago, original practice Shakespeare.
Right.
So you have men playing the female parts as well. And it was really effective, especially when you've got an actor like they have, this actor named Christopher Prentice playing Beatrice. He's a force of nature, and he is wonderful in this production. But I know I'm going to digress here, and lately on the show it's turned into a little bit of Shakespeare hour with me. When you go back to My Own Private Idaho and Henry V making my top five films of 89, it came up last week.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes as well. But
who knew?
Humor me. Humor me just for a second. Let's do a little bit of Masquer Theater. I picked out this scene.
I saw this in the script
it's
that
so
I was wondering
wonderful.
If. Okay.
It's so wonderful. It was eye-opening for me watching this play to discover just how good Shakespeare was, apparently.
And so now you want us to trample all over
it? I want
it?
Us to trample all over it. But imagine watching men in the men parts and men in the women parts mm-hmm. as well, and have a man as Beatrice saying these lines. Josh, I'm going to let you destroy it.
I'm Beatrice.
You're Beatrice. But first, just a little bit of setup for those maybe not familiar with Much Ado About Nothing. At this point, Beatrice's cousin has been shamed publicly. Terrible situation where the man that she thought she was marrying has decided that she is not a good woman.
That's right.
And has cast her aside and just humiliated her in the worst way possible. And Beatrice is very upset about that, about everything that transpired. And she's talking to Benedick, who's been her rival, and the other people in the play have been trying to conspire to get them together. So here we go. Are you ready?
That's your direction to me. Very upset.
Very upset.
This is what I'm going to get.
And action.
Oh, that I were a man for his sake, or that I had any friend would be a man for my sake. But manhood is melted into curtsies, valor into compliment, and men are only turned into tongue and trim ones too. He is now as valiant as Hercules that only tells a lie and swears it. I cannot be a man with wishing, therefore I will die a woman with grieving.
Tarry, good Beatrice, by this hand I love thee.
Use it for my love some other way than swearing by it.
Think you in your soul the Count Claudio hath wronged, hero?
Yea, as sure as I have thought, or a soul.
And seen.
And seen.
That was horrible. But
we're not ready
for Illinois Shakespeare. No, we're not ready for Illinois Shakespeare or any Shakespeare production. But if you want to be a good writer of any kind, even if it's film criticism, just go back and read some of these lines. I cannot be a man with wishing, therefore I will die a woman with grieving. And when she says to him, use your hand for my love some other way than swearing by it. And that last line, yea, as sure as I have a thought or a soul. Man, I'm just going to rip this off over and over again.
Where are we right now?
I had to do it.
I'm like in a Bong Joon-ho movie.
Maybe
and we've completely jumped tracks to some other.
It's really good stuff, and it is a good production, and I hope that a few of you will join us down there on Sunday, July 27th. I will not act, so you have that to look forward to.
You will barely be awake, because we'll be at the live show the previous night.
That's true, actually. Let's go now to some even more bad acting, though I'm not sure we can do any worse than we just did there with Shakespeare. It is Massacre Theater time.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. A few weeks ago on episode 497, we spent some time with our adolescent selves, Adam. We did a Sacred Cow review of Tim Burton's Batman, shared our top five movies of 1989, and we massacred this scene.
Well, Mr. Dalton, you may add 9 staples to your dossier of 31 broken bones. 2 bullet wounds, 9 puncture wounds, and 4 stainless steel screws. That's an estimate, of course. I'll give you a local.
No, thank you.
Do you enjoy pain?
Pain don't hurt.
Most of my patients would disagree with you. Okay. Do you always carry your medical records around with you?
Saves time.
File says you've got a degree from NYU. What in?
Philosophy.
Any particular discipline?
No, not really. Man's search for faith, that sort of.
Come up with any answers?
Not too many.
That was Patrick Swayze as Dalton and Kelly Lynch as Doc in Roadhouse. It was written by David Lee Henry and Hillary Henkin, directed by Rowdy Harrington. Really? Rowdy?
Rowdy.
That's okay. There's a note here from Sam, I presume. Rowdy Harrington, also interestingly, the director of. Actually, that's pretty much it, Roadhouse.
How dare you?
That didn't launch him to
somehow,
a career of...
Somehow it didn't. I learned 2 things from these notes. That Kelly Lynch's name in that movie is Doc. And I've seen Roadhouse about 57 times.
So you're not as big of a fan as you claim.
I guess not. And that the director's name is Rowdy. And I just know our friend Chris Klemek, though, is out there somewhere going, hey now, Striking Distance is an underappreciated Bruce Willis gem. I'm sure he's thinking that that, too, was a Rowdy Harrington joint.
He did get work, is what you're saying.
He did get some work. He made a few films after Roadhouse. But in our bonus content, if I can stay up late enough for us to record some bonus content tonight, Josh, which is available via the FilmSpotting app, just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps if you're interested in more information. We're going to get to some of your feedback on our Batman discussion and our top 5 films of 1989. Listener Rob Cosgrove in Ann Arbor, Michigan, has a really good theory about how it is possible that you haven't seen Field of Dreams. He's got the explanation.
That should be interesting.
He's on to the truth about you, Josh.
I know it wasn't because I was watching Roadhouse.
That is true. Matt McConnell in Philadelphia had this to say about our rendition, about the scene, more to the point. All you really needed to say was pain don't hurt, and I think everyone would have known the film. The connections between Roadhouse and this week's show are, 1, it came out in 1989. 2, both Dalton and Batman dole out their own form of vigilante justice. 3, use of the name Castle, we did sub in the name Castle there instead of Dalton, is a reference to Swayze's character in Dirty Dancing, inferior Swayze film because of a lack of throat ripping. See what you have to look forward to with Roadhouse, Josh?
Sounding better and better.
Matt goes on, though. Lesser known connections? I wanted to be Batman growing up, but had to settle on a philosophy degree.
Mm.
And I coveted a Batman poster as a child and have a Roadhouse poster now, which he attached just to prove it.
To prove it?
In the email.
That is a bold claim.
Matt says, keep up the good work. P.S. I always carry my medical records with me. Matt sounds like a guy you don't want to mess with.
I also heard from Dave Richards in Berlin. First, let me begin with the Massacre Theater movie. It is, of course, Roadhouse, but what truly surprised me was the fact that Josh has not seen this movie. I do understand that Roadhouse may not have the great acting, visionary direction, or existential questioning of, say, A Pain and Gain, but I do not understand how such an 80s classic escaped Josh's viewing. I'm roughly the same age as the both of you, and I reminisce how excited my friends and I were when we saw Roadhouse. Actually, I wonder what kind of an adolescence Josh had where he did not see either Roadhouse or Field of Dreams, but managed to see The Little Mermaid.
The answer? A well-adjusted one.
Idyllic. It was idyllic. Josh may blame not seeing these movies on his lack of cable at that age, but there was this other great invention around that time called a VCR. Top 5 ideas so bad it's good, Roadhouse would definitely make my list.
Yeah, so bad it's good. I want to say Sam and I did that list many, many, many hundreds of shows ago. I could be wrong.
We might have to revive it.
We may have to. We get that one a lot along with Guilty Pleasures, which is sort of similar. And I always kind of push it off because I don't really believe in Guilty Pleasures. I think you just have to embrace your pleasures, whether other people don't like them or not. Obviously, Josh, that fuels your criticism. So,
very good.
Mogan Brown in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood says, it may be a point of interest to add that several years ago, I worked the door at a prominent Chicago night spot. And one evening found myself in the ER after dealing with the scuffle. When recounting to the surgeon what had happened, he asked me if I'd ever seen the movie where Swayze played a bouncer. The words, pain don't hurt, flew out of my punctured lips, and I realized that this was the greatest moment of my life.
See, only the pinnacle of cinema can bring about that sort of bonding.
Man, if you want to hear me do a really bad Swayze rendering of that line, pain don't hurt, that episode is available via podcast on iTunes, or you can listen to the show at filmspotting.net. Josh, you're going to be so depressed to know that this week's Massacre Theater, this Roadhouse Massacre Theater, one of the most entered we've had in a long, long time.
Boy, what does that say? What does that say?
It says that you're out of touch, is what it says, Josh. Reach in to the film spotting hat. It's quite brimming, and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Tad Hildum from City of Cleves, Ohio.
Not to be confused with Cleveland in Ohio. They're nowhere close to each other.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
Email feedback at filmspotting.net, Tad, to claim your film spotting t-shirt.
What happened to the cannoli line?
Max, you're supposed to say forget about it, Sanchez. The old man likes his cannoli.
Look, I made a mistake, all right? It didn't make any difference anyway.
Hey, I'm letting it go. But don't say it doesn't matter. Every line matters.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It is not going to be magic. It's not even going to be real. But
somewhere
we're going to do
between
it anyway. And I always do appreciate accent work here in Massacre Theater. And you picked the scene, Josh, so you're going to take
it. I was just
going to
play
it
straight. You think I should do an accent here? I could really give it away.
I think you have to, because here's a little bit of a hint. You are significantly altering the rhythm of the dialogue, let's say that.
Yeah, I don't quite know how I'm going to do that yet.
Well, you just got to live in the moment.
Okay.
You have to just bring the truth in the moment,
Josh. That's what's going to happen.
I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
Oh, it's awfully dark and gloomy up there.
There now, you see how wrong you can be? That there's what you might call a doorway to a place of enchantment. Up where the smoke is all billowed and curled between pavement and stars is the chimney sweep world. Where there's hardly no day nor hardly no night, there's things half in shadow and halfway in light. And
you can't do the last line?
We're cutting off the last line. I think it gives too much away, and I was losing the accent.
Yes, you were, if you ever had it.
If I ever had it, it was gone at that point.
Wow, I think that may be ever the first cut short Massacre Theater.
There comes a time.
Episode 499 is what it took. If you know what scene Josh just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name.
You were so brilliant.
I was brilliant. Come on. I've been practicing that one line for days. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Friday, July 25th.
More people should know this than Roadhouse, really. I'll be disappointed.
I hope not. I so hope not.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced live during Film Spotting 500 in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
We get to bring back the Larson Recommends jingle, and this time, the name actually applies.
It sounded good before,
yes,
but it sounds much better when I'm actually recommending a movie.
Indeed, and the movie you're going to recommend this week is the movie that inspires our top five magical realism movies. Can't talk about magical realism without talking about Michel Gondry. We already have earlier in the show his new film, Mood Indigo. Why don't you explain, Josh, first of all, what makes it magical, and then what made you enjoy it so much?
Yeah, I mean, it's I do like Michel Gondry. It's his style I've only found overwhelming in one film, and that's The Science of Sleep. So I'll put that out there right now. If you've found any of his films and their whimsy, their aggressive, creative whimsy, not to your liking, you get a lot of it here, a ton of it. But he also does something very interesting that's sort of new. It's, to be honest, a little bit cruel. He uses this to plumb some really dark places. And I know Eternal Sunshine had a little bit of cynicism in it, and it was not, you know, all we think of magical realism, I think, as a happy thing in general, or something that touches on wonder, and Gondry does that. But here, it gets pretty dark. The story basically involves a Parisian bachelor named Colin, played by Romain Duris, and he falls in love with Chloe, played by Audrey Tautou. And they have this falling in love first, maybe third half of the film that's the Gondry we're used to, right? It's whimsical. They ride this cloud cart that a crane carries up and hovers over the city. And it really works. It's touching on sort of capturing the sort of emotions they would be feeling if this was happening to them in normal life, and giving it a visual picture of what they feel like inside. He does the same thing, though, when Chloe falls ill. And suddenly the creativity, these handcrafted effects that he specializes in, they're no longer capturing life's big, good moments, but the grim ones, the tough ones, and all the creative energy. It becomes really darkly evocative. And while I appreciated that as something new from him, it's a really oppressive film. We get moments where, you know, walls closing in on you is a common phrase. Here, when Colin gets a phone call with bad news, that literally happens. Okay, the set's walls move in on him. And there are other little touches where the shadow, as he's running through the street to get to the hospital, his own shadow that's projected on a wall jumps off and starts chasing him to kind of literalize his fear. Their home, which was light and airy, the cobwebs just start suffocating in on it. And the picture holds this through to the end. And I found that admirable in a way, that Gondry is not necessarily going to use whimsy as an escape route, which maybe a lesser artist might do. The movie Mood Indigo, it really understands that sickness can blacken everything when it comes. And so for all this playful imagination the movie has, it's very real and very rough too.
My favorite part of everything you said was where you knocked the science of sleep. One of our producers, Sam, it was among his top 10 favorite movies of the year it came out. So now you'll no longer be his favorite Film Spotting co-host. And that brings me great joy.
That's all it takes.
That's all it takes.
How is Sam on Eternal Sunshine, though?
He loves that.
Yeah, I mean, that's Be Kind, Rewind. I want to know how Sam feels on all of Gondry's films.
You need to be careful moving forward, Josh.
All right. You might want to increase the voltage on that shock system you had installed.
Oh, no.
That's going to restrain me from mentioning Beasts of the Southern Wild. We're about to share
give me a minute to get it ready
of the best magical realism moments in the movies. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Donations and thank you time here, Josh, and we do want to highlight our featured artist this week and give thanks to a listener, David Inman in Nashville, Tennessee. He suggested Caleb Hawley. That's H-A-W-L-E-Y. He says, my friend from New York, Caleb, just released a new EP this week called Side One, and I think some of the tracks here would be great on the show. New York Minute Magazine just recently named him the new voice of Harlem, and I see a big future for him. The tracks here are fantastic, and the backing musicians are incredible. My favorite tracks are Would You Even Try and Crying Wolf. Well, we listened, David, to Caleb's work. We agree. Those two tunes are pretty fantastic, and that's what we played for you here on the show. Again, that's Caleb Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y. Let's get to our donors and our thanks. And Josh, we start with a gold-level donor, and I think we're going to see the Reverend Robert Lewis from Damascus, Maryland. I think he's coming to Film Spotting 500.
Very nice.
Which is going to be great because he has been such a longtime supporter of the show.
This is my semi-annual thank you donation. After a spring and summer semester of teaching two sessions of the course on understanding movies and having my heart ripped out a half dozen times each semester with student comments such as Citizen Kane and Casablanca would be better if they were colorized, I am comforted by listening to Film Spotting. Thanks, as always, for a wonderful show. P.S. How do I get a cooler Film Spotting nickname than Kenilworth?
What's cooler than Kenilworth? It's a Glengarry Glen Ross reference? Come on, Robert.
He's a gold-level donor. I think he deserves a new nickname. Maybe Sam can give him one at the show.
At the show. I think Sam will give him 10 nicknames, if that's what he wants, for that generous donation. We have a new Buck a Show donor, and it's funny because in the PayPal note, the name came through more as like a username, and I really wasn't sure who it was. And then I was pulling these today, Josh, and this listener sent us a note to the show. Turns out this is this listener. It's Jen. She's in Sunnyvale, California. Though she actually signed her email just as Jen, Sunnyvale. And somehow you know it's Sunnyvale, California, because where else could it be? But also,
Florida.
I just love the notion. Yeah, I just love the idea that she's from Sunnyvale.
Yeah.
Like it just exists in its own universe.
Sounds very peaceful.
It does, doesn't it? We also have two new Silver Club donors, Chun in Roswell, Georgia, and Rob Cosgrove. He's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's the one I teased we're going to hear from in bonus content. We're going to hear from him now as well.
As a perpetually financially challenged listener, I'm commemorating the upcoming 500th show with a dime a show donation.
Love it.
And I invite others like me to do the same and pay the dealer however you can. 500 dimes equals 500 thank yous for 500 wonderful shows. A small gesture of priceless gratitude for giving me so much pleasure. May there be many, many, many more. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rob. That is a wonderfully generous donation. We thank all of our donors, whether it's a one-time thing or $2, $5, maybe even $10 a month. It does keep us doing what we're doing. And if you can't donate right now, if you're one of those financially challenged listeners, we obviously understand. And there are other ways you can help us. You can visit some of our sponsor websites, some of the links we give out on the show, whether you're looking to buy or not, or just rate us on iTunes. It's a great way to help the show get visibility and get new listeners. Quick thank yous as well, Josh. Some listeners I want to give a shout out to. Sebastian Nebel, who we both follow on Twitter, another longtime listener of the show, helped out with finding a clip for me. I was looking for a specific portion from Apocalypse Now to play this week in my Ebert class. He helped me find it. Greg Berlin, one of our FAB members, Joran Kane, another longtime listener, they both helped me pick out certain scenes I was looking for my first Ebert class in conjunction with The Marriage of Maria Braun and what was the other one? The Third Man, I think. Those were movies and some scenes that Ebert particularly loved that were singled out in his memoir, Life Itself. And I needed some assistance with people who knew those films better than I did in finding those scenes. And it's really great, obviously, that we can reach out to this network of listeners that we have, and they can help us out with whatever we need. We have a really great group. So thank you to Sebastian, Greg, Joran, and everyone else who's helped us out recently.
What is the price of happiness? From WBEZ Chicago comes a reimagining of the radio drama. The dark and gritty serial podcast told through the lives of the ne'er-do-wells and paragons that make up this turn-of-the-century settlement.
Town where happiness was the main objective.
But that plan went up in flames. Still, there was beauty in the journey.
Yes, we strayed from the path. Yes, people got hurt. There was betrayal, and there was murder. But it was one hell of a ride.
Listen to the rise and fall of a hedonistic dream at wbez.org/pleasuretown.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
But the fact remains is that you don't have the money to bring the mortgage up to date, so you're still going to have to sell. I'm sorry, Ray. We got no choice.
Ray. People will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door, as innocent as children, longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it. For it is money they have, and peace they like.
Ray.
The great James Earl Jones ushers us into the realm of the unreal with that clip from Field of Dreams. This week's top five, magic realism movie moments. And Josh, I'm really hoping that you can set up for our listeners and for me what exactly constitutes a magic realism movie moment, because I've done my entire top five and frankly have no clue.
You haven't figured this out
No.
yet. This was really hard until I had to answer that question and really make up my own definition so that I could push things aside and kind of focus on what was left. And so that's where I started. I decided I'm not going to do dreams. I'm not going to do, you know, visions or hallucinations. Mm-hmm. I set aside memories as well.
Yeah.
So maybe even something like Eternal Sunshine might not fit, because I think the majority of those magical realist moments we think of are memories.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was this. Magical realism was when fantasy intruded on an otherwise realistic story.
Okay. We're in lockstep so far.
Okay. That helped. I mean, it was this moment that it had to leave me wondering how what happened just happened within the framework of the story. And then I think what makes the good ones and the ones that ended up being on my list are those that enhanced the experience of that story rather than jolting us or jarring us to the point that we were taken out of it. I think that's the dangerous game filmmakers play when they deal with magical realism, mm-hmm. is how far can you push that or use that so that it enhances your story rather than comes at the expense of it.
Okay, you're number five.
Is that helpful to you?
Let's just
while
jump
I
right
talk,
in.
You can.
We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
My number five. Well, usually magical realism is associated with something that's wondrous or affirming. I think that's what comes to mind for me. But I'm going to start my list with something that's deeply unnerving, actually. And it comes from Post Tenebras Lux. This is a recent Carlos Regadas film about a wealthy husband and a father of two young children who's moved his family to rural Mexico. Partly, I at least took this as an exploration of the father's inner demons. And near the start, we see that literalized. Early on, while the family is sleeping, a horned, hoofed, and decidedly naked, glowing red demon figure prowls through the house, inexplicably carrying this toolbox. It's not just that this is a demon and the image itself is creepy, which it is, but it's also how it moves. It's stalking. I got this clear sense of stalking, very slow, very deliberate, looking for something. And the fact that this is taking place in an otherwise normal, quiet home in slumber makes it really an insidious bit of magical realism for me. Post Tenebras Lux it's a puzzler overall. We never get a clear explanation of the demon figure, at least that I was aware of. And the only thing I did sense throughout, for sure, is that there was this theme of defilement that was prominent in the picture. And this moment certainly echoes that very early on.
Still a movie I need to see. And hearing about this demon actually makes me more excited to see it.
You didn't know about the demon, huh?
No, I wasn't aware. I knew it was out there.
It's a rough go as a picture overall, but yeah, you'll want to catch up with it.
Well, we came into this segment with Field of Dreams, and again, we recently did our top five films of 1989. Field of Dreams made my list, and I singled out, in a movie filled with magic realism moments, I singled out my favorite, and that's why I'm going to call this list the I'm Archie Graham Field of Dreams Memorial List. That moment in the car with James Earl Jones and Kevin Costner is wonderful, but actually, even as it is my memorial list, Field of Dreams really wasn't eligible for me, Josh, because as I thought about the types of films and the types of moments I wanted to choose, it just didn't completely apply because I wanted to focus on examples where the whole film is absolutely realistic, and then you do get it broken by this spell, some kind of enchantment. And obviously, Field of Dreams, although set in Iowa in the 80s and whatever, and is very realistic in some ways, it is fantastic throughout. There are many unexplainable things that happen that you just have to accept. And so movies like that, even like the movie we opened with here on the show, The Purple Rose of Cairo, that's an amazing moment when Tom Baxter looks mm-hmm. through the screen and sees Cecilia and then comes out of the screen into the theater. That's obviously magic in a movie that's otherwise realistic. But then the whole film goes on from there with this premise that he can walk around New York City having come out of the screen. So that just didn't completely work for me. So that was at least what I was shooting for.
You did make it tough for yourself.
I really did. And I even went so far as to talk to an expert, Josh. I do this from time to time. We have listeners who are experts on a variety of subjects.
You found someone with a PhD in magical realism?
Well, I don't know what her qualifications are, but she made a lot of sense. There's a listener, we referenced her a few times recently. She won Massacre Theater. Erin Perry, she lives in mm-hmm. West Des Moines. Turns out she's a teacher. I don't know at what level, but she teaches magic realism sometimes as a subject, as a theme in literature courses.
Okay.
Sometimes she brings film in. So I was kind of running some of my choices by her and some of the things that I thought didn't work or thought did work. And I think she said this really well. She says, magical realism requires ambiguity, a pull back and forth between the fantasy and the reality. If the story explains the fantastical elements, then it's no longer magical realism. So I think Field of Dreams kind of falls into that, though Not that there's an actual explanation. So, for instance, in Like Water for Chocolate or Chocolat, there's no explanation for how the food can cause such strong emotional changes in the people who eat it. Thematically, magical realism tends to display a conflict between traditional ways of thinking and more modern logical ones. That all sounds really good. And later in our exchange, she said one thing that makes magical realism in film a little harder is that the camera is much more authoritative than the words on the page of a novel. If we see it, we believe it first.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to use that as my excuse for why I struggled so much putting this list together.
I like that. I think your point about ambiguity is dead on. I wouldn't want any of these moments explained either. That's where the magic ends.
So having said all that now and set that up, I'm not sure my number five pick at all meets those requirements, but I'm going with it nevertheless. And I'm mainly going with it just to infuriate you slightly, Josh, because I know you're not a fan of this movie. But I am going with Michael Haneke's Funny Games.
Oh, we're going to have this talk.
Eventually, we're going to have this talk. I don't think this is maybe the forum. But the moment in Funny Games, everyone who has seen it will know as the rewind scene or the remote control scene. And the reason I struggle with this was that's just an overt meta cinematic moment. It's a breaking the fourth wall type of moment where no one's looking right at the camera, but clearly the director is saying, hey, by the way, audience, I know you're out there. This is a movie. And I don't think that those moments in cinema are always magical realism. You can look at a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and see Matthew Broderick talking to the camera. I don't think that's magical realism. It's just a cinematic device. But I think it's different in this context to Funny Games, where it becomes something. It's isolated, first of all, and it's something that affects all of the characters within this world on the screen. It changes everything that came immediately before it and everything that comes after it. If you know this film, the setup is basically a family, Tim Roth and Naomi Watts. They have a son and a dog. They go to their lake house and they're confronted by two mysterious men. And I went back and looked at my notes when we reviewed this film. And basically what I came away with is that moment, that's such a defining moment. It's near the end of the film with the remote control. And it's a scene where you really have to see it, but the moment we've sort of all been waiting for, because we've seen so many Hollywood movies and because we want it to happen. We want these monsters, these villains, to get their punishment and have one of these people, the husband or the wife, save the day. They finally get a hold of the shotgun and they get up and blast the bad guy. But then he just finds the remote control and he rewinds the scene. And then when she reaches for the gun, he knows she's going to do it and he stops it from happening. And I know this movie and that moment bugs a lot of critics, but it never bothered me that Haneke was basically giving us this moment of sweet revenge and then ripping it away from us and rewinding the movie there. It just didn't bother me at all. I don't think he's calling me a sucker for enjoying that moment. I do think he is forcing me to consider why I got so excited for it, why I was so prepared for it to happen and enjoyed the moment, and then also how it is that Hollywood has prepared me to think that moment's going to happen. And what he ultimately says is that, you know, the hero doesn't always save the day. There are no heroes sometimes. Sometimes there are just bad guys who play by their own rules and wreak havoc. And I found the movie, especially after seeing, if anyone goes back to that review, we had just discussed No Country for Old Men not too long before that, similar in themes in terms of saying, you know what, this isn't the way the world works anymore, if it ever did. There's a certain lawlessness and incivility, and when people are willing to play by rules that they make up, then that's going to be a problem. And we see that problem, and I think that there is something poignant about that, even as it's a challenging film, and for some people, unnecessarily provocative and annoying. That's fine. I get it. I don't feel that way about it. And I love that moment.
I think it certainly counts as magical realism. I would consider that. I still don't think it counts as an accomplished film, though I completely understand that it's working really at the level of film criticism,
mm-hmm.
Certainly. And I think that's why people do get behind it and champion it, because they like that meta nature of it. But for me, it still doesn't make it any more compelling than the films it's critiquing. Just having the knowledge that that's what it's doing doesn't elevate it.
Well, let's see if I approve of your number four, Josh.
I think you will.
Okay.
Because you introduced me to it in a way.
Okay.
It's the moment where cherry blossoms fall from above in floating weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And this we just watched together at your University of Chicago class. You're teaching right now, going through some of Ebert's favorite films, and you included Yasujirō Ozu's 1959 drama. It's a set in a small fishing village where an itinerant theater troupe has come to perform. Very much an ensemble piece, but one of the subplots that is going on involves this romance between a college-bound boy, played by Hiroshi Kawaguchi, and the troupe's younger actress, played by Ayako Wakao. Now, there are complications here because, well, one thing is she's seducing him at the request of another actress. You also get the impression that this kid has never broken a rule in his life, mm-hmm. perhaps. And all of that comes into play in this quiet scene in which they secretly rendezvous in a back hall at the Village's theater. It's very tentative. He's hesitant because of his inexperience. And also, it's a film very much about class status. So he's not sure about her having a lower social status and if he should be engaging with her. And she's, of course, conflicted because she's pretending this whole time to be in love with him. But they do kiss. And as they embrace, cherry blossoms suddenly start drifting from above. And it's a really remarkable moment. And given the tensions underlying this scene, it's this delicate dollop of grace at that mm-hmm. moment. And we spent time in class actually afterwards talking about, we were wondering about the architecture of the right. theater itself, if there might have been an opening in the roof or something like that for these blossoms to enter. And, I'm still not quite sure. And that gets back to the idea of ambiguity. Right. That sense of mystery is at the heart of magical realism. So the cherry blossoms from Floating Weeds, my number four.
Yeah, an honorable mention for me, one I strongly considered. I'm glad to see it on your list. There is something wonderful about those moments and certainly resonate thematically. You see them for a reason when they happen, and they give you this sense of time passing and a new season approaching, and the movie very much deals with that sense of adulthood and mortality. So great pick. My number four is one I have absolutely no doubts about. I feel very good about this pick, Josh, so it's a good feeling here. It is The Double Life of Veronique, which is from director Krzysztof Kieślowski. It was a film discussed here in Film Spotting as part of our Kieślowski marathon. I have to thank critic Jake Cole on Twitter for reminding me of this scene. I might have actually overlooked it. It was a standout scene from that marathon for me. And this is a moment where we have Irene Jacob, wonderful actress, so good in this film. And she plays a dual role. She plays Veronique and Veronica, who we sort of see at different points in this movie and are not completely sure how they're related, even though obviously they look very much the same. And there's just this wonderful moment where Veronica, I believe she's just gotten notice of an audition she's going to. She's a musician. She's very excited. She's going through these streets of Paris and a protest breaks out and there's a bus with some tourists who are getting on the bus. And one of them and probably others are snapping photos of the protesters. And in this moment, Veronica looks up and she sees her double. She sees Veronique get on that bus and it just goes away. And you just see this glance that happens as they spy each other and as she sees her pull away. And it is this absolutely metaphysical moment where there's no way as you're watching it that this should be happening. There's no way in real life that we all out there have a double. And so that was what was so fascinating for me about this moment and for this list, because it's undeniably a moment of magical realism. As I said, you can't have truly a doppelganger of you existing in the world, but it also serves to take the movie out of the realm of the metaphysical, which it's been up to this point, and it grounds it in the natural world. It actually does serve the counter purpose in the context of the film, because it becomes clear that Kieślowski is saying to us, no, there really are two versions of this woman in this world. Same age, same relationships with their fathers, same relationships to music. That is what he's suggesting in a very straightforward way. And so that does set up everything that follows after it. But the moment for me is still all about just that glance when Veronica first sees almost an apparition. It seems like this can't be happening, that I'm seeing me across the way. And it does, in that moment, it kind of makes you gasp a little bit, because it is as shocking to you as it is to her in that moment. And it sort of makes you consider what it would be like if you came across another version of you out there in the real world.
Yeah, I think that also speaks to the fact that you can't shortchange the realism in a film when you're trying to do this, mm-hmm. because if you overplay the fantastic or the metaphysical, then you've kind of lost this delicate balance that you're going for. But grounding in realism really helps. Maybe that doesn't happen so much in my number three. I threw this out there as a possibility and you balked at it, so you might not approve. But I went with the fight scenes in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. This is Edgar Wright's adaptation of the Brian Lee O'Malley graphic novels about the romantic travails of a Toronto bass player played by Michael Cera. And there are a lot of dollops of magical realism throughout, I would say. When the drums are hit, you get animated stars that burst into the air when Scott plays his bass. These big, bold letter Ds pump across the screen. I like the touch at one point when a character's frustrated and her face turns into an emoticon. So you see a lot of this, but the extended scenes where it really blossoms, I think, are the ones where Scott takes on the seven evil ex-boyfriends of his current crush. These battles are accompanied by on-screen graphics that provide scores or information about his opponents. And Scott and his foes have these superhero powers, so they're super strong or they can fly. And all of this, of course, is an inflated dramatization of what's going on in Scott's head. It's the fact that his love life is this do-or-die scenario, and it's envisioned with the grammar of video games.
Mr. Pilgrim! It is I, Matthew Patel. Consider our fight begun!
What did I do? What do I do?
And the movie, it's just so tapped into its hero's consciousness here that when he covers his eyes at one point, the screen goes blank.
Yeah.
Another great touch. So Scott Pilgrim, I sometimes think of as being, you know, the best comic book movie and video game movie ever made at the same time. Mm. Somehow Wright manages to pull that off. It employs the formal elements from each medium to create something entirely cinematic. And I think magical realism is one of the tools that it uses to do that.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I wonder
not
if
buying it.
Listeners will agree with you. I mean, I think for me, it just does fall into that realm. You said it. It's a comic book movie and a video game movie at once. It employs those elements. And so there's a sense that there's never really a surprise with any of those flourishes it takes for me. And I guess just at least with my list, I was thinking about those moments of surprise. But I do like that movie, not quite as much as you, but I like it and I like that scene quite a bit. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five magic realism movie moments. And my number three is one that means this movie is probably due for the penalty box here at some point. I feel like it's come up a fair amount recently, but I had to include it on this list. And it's one of the end scenes, really the finale of the Coen Brothers' Barton Fink. I'll Show You the Life of the Mind. John Goodman, the star really here, is Charlie or Madman Munt at the end of this film. And it's hard, too, picking just one Coen Brothers moment, because they really do exist in this world of magical realism. They love to employ fantastical elements throughout their films, even the ones that are the most grounded. I considered a movie even like Inside Llewyn Davis, which I don't think has a whole lot of magic to it, but there is a sequence we talked about when we reviewed it where he's driving to Chicago, mm-hmm. I think, with the John Goodman character in the car, yeah. And he's sleeping, and the other passenger is sleeping, and it becomes almost this netherworld, driving through the night, and the sound of the interstate, and the darkness of it. You get the sense that he's an Odysseus-like character, and he's out there struggling to get somewhere, and that's a moment that I think almost does work as magical realism, but this Barton Fink moment for me is one of my favorite Coen Brothers scenes, and it truly is the culmination of the entire film, where you've got John Turturro as this playwright turned screenwriter, Hollywood screenwriter, stuck in this terrible Hotel Earl, and heat is a conceit throughout the entire film. It keeps getting hotter and hotter, and that does coincide with this Charlie character who lives next door or right nearby on that floor. As he gets closer and closer to Barton and we see more of him, it gets hotter and harder. And this purgatory, where it's said early in the film, you can stay for a day or a lifetime, it finally becomes a hell, an actual hell at the end of this film. But the magic is it doesn't burn down. The whole hotel seems to be on fire, but it just surrounds John Goodman's character and it moves with him. It stays still when he's still and it follows him down the hallway with the flames getting bigger and bigger. It almost is as if he controls it, as if he is maybe some kind of Satan-like figure here in this scene. And there's no real sense of fear on the part of anyone in the scene. There are two cops there. They're afraid of him. They think he's dangerous, but they don't seem surprised at all by the heat and the fact that the fire is following him. So nobody acts as if all of a sudden this doesn't make sense. And it's a moment that we could actually spend whole podcast just dissecting and unpacking sort of the symbolism of that and what the movie as a whole is about. But just watching John Goodman rush down that hotel floor really for me is just one of the real thrills of that film.
Look upon me! I'll show you the life of the mind! Ah! 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 Look upon me! Ah! I'll show you the life of the mind! I'll show you the life of the mind! I'll show you the life of the mind!
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to nail down a Coen Brothers moment because they came to mind right away and I just couldn't do it. You're right. You could probably detect something. I'm thinking about A Serious Man, maybe not, but the finale
that, you could argue, you're absolutely right.
Something they're absolutely great at. My number two comes from a filmmaker you don't associate with magical realism at all, and that's John Sayles. But he made a film, The Secret of Roan Inish, in 1994 that veers a bit from the pretty straightforward material he usually works in. This is a family drama that's based on the Irish legend of Selkies, so seals that can shed their skin and become human. This is mostly a story about storytelling, though, and how folk tales and real life intermingle, so you can see how it is rich soil for magical realism. The basic story is that a young girl goes to live with her grandparents in an Irish fishing village, and there she hears all sorts of tales about her family's past, especially when they used to live on this nearby island of Roan Inish. And one of the oft-repeated stories is about how her baby brother floated away in his cradle one day while the family was moving off the island and he was never found. So she begins to mingle this family legend with the Selkie legends and wondering if maybe, just maybe, Selkies have been protecting her little brother all these years. There's this really wonderful, ambiguous moment about halfway through where the girl, and she's played by Jenny Courtney, is sitting on this boat that's tied to a dock and a fog rolls in. And the boat starts drifting away and she realizes the rope has been frayed, but we don't know how. And then we see popping up here and there in the water are seals, which just silently look at her. And I don't know how they did this, but whether they were real seals or what they used, but they have this, and maybe it's just the storytelling getting to me, they have this human quality to them, the way they're looking at her, and then they would disappear. And the boat sort of, you're not sure if it's moving or not, if it's traveling through the fog. Is the wind pushing her? Are the seals pulling her? But eventually she finds herself at Roan Inish. Mm-hmm. And some more ambiguous magic happens there, but I won't give that away. It's really a lovely little film, different for Sayles, but well worth tracking down. The Secret of Roan Inish.
It is a lovely little film, and it's a Sayles movie. I'd always considered myself a big fan of his, and I hadn't seen Roan Inish until 2005, my first visit to Ebertfest. Sam and I went to Ebertfest.
Oh, they played it
there?
It
was shown on a Sunday afternoon. I think it was the last movie we saw before we came home. They tend to try to program a sort of family movie on Sunday afternoon, and we were both really taken with it and really surprised by it, actually. That's a great pick. My number two, the image speaks for itself. The scene speaks for itself. We'll link to it in our show notes. It's our namesake, Trainspotting, from Danny Boyle, and it's the toilet dive. It is, of course, the scene where Renton, played by Ewan McGregor, well, how do you describe this? I don't know that I want to describe it here on a nice family NPR show.
It's pretty icky.
But he is a drug addict who is trying to basically have his last, he thinks he's going to kick it and this is going to be his last experience with heroin, but all he can get his hands on are two opium suppositories. And then as he's walking down the street, apparently has a case of diarrhea, has to go into a bathroom, goes into this place where there's a toilet, and as we learn, it's the worst toilet in Scotland. The text comes up on the screen. And when you go in, you believe it. It truly feels like the worst possible place you could ever be, bathroom or any other type of room. And he does decide to use the facility, but in the process, loses the opium suppositories. And much to all of our horror as we watch it, for anyone who recalls this scene, you know that he goes in after it. He goes in to the point where, and this is where the magic comes in, there's the magic finally, Josh, in this really gross scene. He goes in after, and physically his whole body goes into the water, and we see him then go into this ocean-like setting as he goes in to retrieve those suppositories. And it works, I think, and it works for this list because not only is it just a fun visual moment, but it's not a dream, it's not a nightmare. Later, we get a nightmare when he's trying to kick drugs and we get the baby on the ceiling and that. But I think this sequence actually sets the table for what a real nightmare looks like or what a real dream or hallucination is. At this point, he's not under the influence of any drugs. I think we're supposed to probably interpret it as simply this is sort of where he goes in his mind, right, to deal with the horror of this experience. But everything from the music and just the visualization of that ocean or that lagoon that he goes down into is a perfect counter to the abject revulsion we feel as viewers watching him in that bathroom.
Yeah, not an example of wondrous or affirming magical realism,
no.
but definitely works. You know, the other one I thought about that comes from Danny Boyle actually is in Millions, the scenes of the boy talking to the saints. We never quite get a clear picture of how that's happening either. So I like that. All right, my number one, it's the dance sequence in The Red Shoes. And this is the Paul Pressburger Technicolor Wonder from 1948, based on the Hans Christian Andersen tale about a pair of magical ballet slippers that force a girl to dance to her death. In the movie, the dancer is Vicky Page, played by Moira Shearer, and she's a new member of this world-famous company. The film includes her breakout performance in a production of The Red Shoes, which the movie indulges in for a good 15 minutes. I did try to stay away from musicals, but I think this one, I don't know that I consider The Red Shoes as a musical, for one thing. But also, I think it works differently from the others that will jump in and out of their musical sequences in that it does set aside this huge chunk, and it's important that it starts with the opening of a curtain in a traditional theater. So it's grounded very much in reality. We have this familiar stage, a spotlight, even see familiar seats, and we know where we are. We're somewhere real. And then it's a slow process the scene takes where it gets increasingly goes somewhere else. There are stage effects that are, again, familiar but heightened. And we get a broader view of the sets in the background and so forth. Then movie effects come more into play. Vicky sees herself dancing in a mirror and there are superimposed images. Eventually, after she dons the red shoes, she goes off soaring into this multicolored sky that's something, it's like it's beyond stage and screen at this point. And how is this taking place, we wonder, even within the stage's reality that we thought we were in. So I just like how stage and cinema fully merge here into something entirely all its own, and you could call it magical realism.
Well, you're certainly not going to get any argument from me on The Red Shoes. I love it being included on any list. And I think you're right. It's probably not really a musical. Technically, it doesn't go in and out of musical numbers. It does give you a lot of dance numbers, certainly. But I try to avoid musicals as well because it's its own top five list. And you see a lot of times these flights of fancy in those types of
numbers. And we accept them more, I think.
And you do.
Too,
you completely accept them. But that all being said, I really strongly considered, and I guess just bumped it down to honorable mentions, the royal wedding sequence with Fred Astaire, where he goes from singing and dancing in his room to then dancing on the ceiling, walking up and down the walls, where that becomes obviously a little bit of magic in an otherwise real setting, but didn't quite make the list for me. What did make my list, what is my number one, is a movie that actually, for as much as I love it, has been conspicuously absent on top five lists over the years. So maybe I'm making up for it here with Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. And I think there are two sequences you can point to, and I'm going to include them because they do sort of coincide with each other, though you could argue about whether one of them is truly a magical realism moment. And it also includes a bit of singing, to go back to the musical discussion here. I'm thinking, first of all, of the Amy Mann Wise Up sequence, where every character you've seen in this movie, all these disparate storylines, some of them connected, some of them not, finally converge in this moment where all this pain that we've seen on screen, it just comes out in this emotional catharsis where they all individually, the camera cuts between these different scenarios where they're all singing this Amy Mann song. As you watch it, it is one of those moments. I remember seeing it in the theater and everybody in the audience kind of going like, what the hell is happening here? Because you can almost for a second think that someone's sitting in their car hearing it on the radio. Or Melora Walters, her character, I think she's the first one we see, and she could be listening to it in her apartment and singing along. But then when you get to all these different scenarios, including Jason Robards, the dying man, singing these words, you know there's no actual explanation for this. It really is just this magical moment where these characters all are connected through this song. But of course, I don't think you can talk about Magnolia without talking about the frogs. The raining down of frogs that is obviously inexplicable. You have to really go back to the Bible to try to find any type of basis for it. And I'm going to just read here what Roger Ebert had to say. He says, all leads to the remarkable famous sequence near the film's end when it rains frogs. Yes, countless frogs, still alive, all over Los Angeles, falling from the sky. That this device has sometimes been joked about puzzles me. I find it a way to elevate the whole story into a larger realm of inexplicable but real behavior. There you go. There's the definition right there. We need something beyond the human to add another dimension. Frogs have rained from the sky die 8 times this century, but never mind the facts. Attend instead to Exodus 8:2, which is cited on a placard in the film, and if thou refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. Let who go? In this case, I believe it refers not to people, but to fears, shames, sins. Can't say it any better than that. Thank you, Roger Ebert. Magnolia, wise up, and The Raining of Frogs, my number one.
Yeah, and maybe Ebert's got it there. I need to develop a stronger position on the frog scene, to be honest with
really?
You. Really? I don't think I've seen Magnolia since it came out, and I liked it
I don't think
quite
I have
a bit.
Either.
But it did take me out of the movie
well, I think
in a way.
It's going to.
Right, but as I was talking about before, for me, it's an honorable mention for me. I mean, I think it's a, you know, really... It does have an element of magic, but it was also a jarring experience in a way that I was talking about before may not serve the story immediately. It does when you pause and go back and are like, okay, that's mm-hmm. right. This verse was there,
right.
Which isn't to say that that's wrong. I mean, we want movies to challenge us and to be rewarding on multiple viewings. So I'm really looking forward to, I hope I'll be able to fit this in watching Anderson's films in order, all in preparation for Inherent Vice. And so I can't wait to get to Magnolia at that point and see how the frogs hit me this time.
You can do that like you did with Wes Anderson
yeah.
and have done with others and just make me feel terrible. Make me feel derelict in my duties.
Come along. You can do it too.
I wish, Josh.
He makes short films.
Right. Those are our top five magic realism movie moments. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Well, let me say, this is the Beast of the Southern Wild Memorial list for
okay.
me too, because I don't think you can beat that moment of Hush Puppy meeting the beasts. I mean, that would be my number one.
I can think of a few. But.
Oh, so good. Uncle Boon Mee, who can recall his past lives, a number of them there, maybe the apparition at dinner would be the one I'd pick. Brad Pitt, here's where I'm going to admit my deep appreciation for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Okay.
I think that film works on levels that Fincher films rarely do,
mm-hmm.
and it's really good, and a lot of it depends on magical realism.
I'll confess to liking that movie more than a lot of people did. I was actually
pretty favorable
during our review, though I hate everything about Brad Pitt in the movie.
Oh,
so
he makes it work.
Wow.
Big, David Moscow turning into Tom Hanks, the scuba diving, and all of a sudden you get those bizarre fish in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Grand Central Ballroom Dance and The Fisher King, a lot of Amelie, a lot of being John Malkovich. Yeah, I think those were the other ones I considered.
Well, you mentioned Floating Weeds and The Cherry Blossoms. You also mentioned Uncle Boon Mee, which got strong consideration for my top five. That moment with the visitor at dinner time is really something. Charlie Kaufman, Synecdoche, New York. The moment, there are, of course, a lot of crazy moments in that film, but I'm thinking of the scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman is on a date with Samantha Morton, and to go back to my Barton Fink pick, her house is just on fire.
Yeah.
There's just
yeah.
fire emanating from the house for no explainable reason. I love that. I thought about one to go back again to the musicals discussion or those kind of sequences. The Fisher King, Terry Gilliam, when we get the Grand Central Station dance scene. I guess that's probably a vision from the Perry character's head. Maybe
that's
we
a good question.
It,
yeah, if those are visions,
it's still a magical moment. And that's really it. I think you could go with other ones, like I said, like Purple Rose and Midnight in Paris, a movie I didn't love from Woody Allen, but some of those first scenes where he goes back into the mm-hmm. past and gets to meet Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Buñuel, that's great stuff.
Yeah, I think
there
that would
is
count.
Something really wondrous about those scenes. Again, those are our top five. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting, that's Adam, and at Larson on Film, that's me. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
A quick note about some current releases that are out there. Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, my number one movie of the year so far mm-hmm. a few weeks ago. I think I made a mistake. I don't know, just got some bad information or just read it wrong, that I thought it wasn't coming out on DVD until August. It's actually out now.
It yeah.
came out just this past Tuesday. So if you want to catch up with that film finally, didn't get to see it when it was in theaters, that's out on DVD now. And my number three movie of the year, Mistaken for Strangers, it's that documentary that's sort of not really about the band The National. It's the iTunes movie of the week. So hopefully people listening to this, I don't know how long that week goes, but it's available on iTunes. It's only a buck to rent right now. So some of my favorites anyway, available now if you need to see them. Out in wide release this weekend, Planes, Fire and Rescue. It's the sequel to Planes. Purge, The Anarchy. It's the sequel to The Purge. And Sex, Tape. It's the sequel to Sex.
I don't
Actually,
think that's right.
That's not true at all. It's a comedy in which we're asked to believe that Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel are A, married, and B, see the title of the film.
Now, don't knock Diaz for snagging a younger man.
You know what? That's a good point. There are a host of releases worth mentioning out in Chicago this weekend, but in the interest of time, we'll highlight a couple. Venus in Fur, Roman Polanski's latest film with Emmanuel Seigner and Matthew Almeric. That is out now. It's also available via cable on demand. And Wish I Was Here, Zach Braff, the much maligned Zach Braff and his Kickstarter-funded follow-up to Garden State. That's out in theaters as well.
We might have to catch up to that since we both actually like Garden State.
Yeah, we're on record as liking that.
We're the only two who don't like The Immigrant. We could also possibly be the only two this year who like Wish I Was Here.
I love it. Just
should
mass,
we go for it?
Mass unsubscriptions. Let's do it. Why not? Also out, well, a little movie called Boyhood. Richard Linklater finally opening here in Chicago this weekend. 12 years in the making of that film. Next week, we are taking a week off, how dare us, to prep for Film Spotting number 500 live. We've done 499 shows. You can take a week off, I think. Please do join us at the Music Box on Saturday night, July 26th. We'll share our top five movies of the Film Spotting era, 2005 to 2014. Michael Phillips will be there. Dana Stevens will be there. The great director Ryan Johnson will be there remotely. You'll see him on the big screen discussing his favorite films and Star Wars. If you can't make it to the live show, you will hear Film Spotting 500 the following week on the radio and via podcast. And somehow this is true. We're going to take a week off after that. Our next in-studio show, Josh, isn't going to air until Friday, August 15th.
We're slacking.
I know. We're going to slack, I think. Maybe, hopefully, we'll earn it with that 500th show, and that's the show where we will finally dive into Boyhood. I am really disappointed that we're not going to get to it earlier because I am so excited to see it.
Yeah, a little bit of bad timing there, but that's all right. I think people are going to be seeing this over time and multiple times, so we'll be ready for a conversation. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from Caleb Hawley and his new EP, Side One. More information is at calebhawley.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Mic check 1, 2, 3.
I cannot believe the crap you're taking on that.
I haven't looked at it since earlier today. I don't. It's fun. At this point, it's just funny. Like, it's just funny.
And well, here's the funny thing to me.
Your line's worse. Yeah, that's hilarious to me too.
Yes.
Your line is far more egregious.
This is the price you pay for 1,000 more followers.
See, it's so funny you note that, Josh, because I wondered to myself.
That's why I didn't jump in.
I'm like,
you were trying to direct people towards you were
no,
like, yeah, and you were no, trying to push them off my way.
I did make the comment in all honesty that your line's better than mine, but I didn't want to push them on you. But it's so funny because your line is far more explicit and egregious than mine.
It is.
And
yet I still don't think it's a spoiler.
It's not.
Okay.
Because it's not. And so I'm looking, I'm going like, Josh has like four comments and they're totally innocuous. And meanwhile, I've got this barn burner going on. And why is it? So I went and looked at your followers. I'm like, well, he's got over 2,000. That's a fair number. I'm like, okay, well, I've got over 3,000.
Uh-huh.
That 1,000 followers
it's
must make all the difference.
Thousand. You've got the wrong 1,000. Oh.